Hey, Annette, it's Maggie.
Hi, it's nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you, too. Can you hear me all right?
I can.
Awesome.
It's a little loud on this end, and I apologize. It's an open bay phone system, so it's going to be noisy at times. It's the lunch hour here.
Annette Cahill is the first person I have spoken with who lived their entire life before being arrested, charged, and convicted for a crime they say they did not commit.
I'm sorry. I'm just kind of tearful. I cry real easy.
She's 61, has a husband, children, great-grandchildren, and 5 years ago, that all got taken away. Tell me about being in your 60s in prison. I mean, it's not like you grew up there.
Oh.
You just got there.
No. It is, every day is culture shock. It really truly is. There's nothing about prison where I think I'm going to get used to this someday. This is a nightmare.
And I know you've been painted a certain way in the media, so I want to give you the opportunity to talk about who you really are, okay?
Okay. Yeah, that would be refreshing. My name is Annette Cahill, and I have been wrongfully incarcerated for almost exactly 5 years. It happened on September 19th, 2019.
This is Wrongful Conviction with Maggie Freeling. Today, Annette Cahill. Annette Cahill was born December 12th, 1962.
I grew up in a little tiny town of less than 400 people, Nichols, Iowa. And it was, podunk, itty bitty. And, you know, it was the cliche, we grew up so poor we didn't know we were poor.
Money was tight raising seven kids.
It goes myself, Lori, Renee, Benny, Charlie, Mike, and Tom. And Renee and Benny were 4 years apart, but the rest of us are all just 2 years apart.
Wow.
Yeah, we're Catholic.
Did you guys grow up going to church?
We did until I think I was six when we stopped going. I don't know if it was actually true or not, but it was kind of family lore that it had something to do with a dispute with the church about paying for a pew, a church fundraiser paying for a pew. That's what we always heard. So we quit going to church. Mom said I could, so I did.
Annette's mom stayed home raising the kids, and Annette's dad spent most of his time working.
And it was a feed company.
Mm.
And then he farmed on the side.
Annette rarely got to spend time with her dad, but when she did,
it was always on Sundays. We would take a ride in the truck, and we would pick bluebells. And his mom loved bluebells, so we would pick her bouquets of bluebells and take them to her. And that was just a fun time. I think it was just to get out of mom's hair that he would pick us girls out. It didn't cost a thing. It was just to spend time.
But Annette says her dad's main priority was to keep food on the table.
He was just always working. And then he had a stroke. And my mom went to work then at a company in West Liberty Oil.
Annette says it was tough providing even just the basics for seven kids on a one-parent income. So she and her siblings would work in the fields, sorting out good corn from bad corn.
What we used to call deroguing, cut corn out of beans in the summer and detasseled, and not a steady job, but always doing something, always earning money on the side.
Annette was the youngest of the seven, so she says she had it easier than her older siblings.
Being the youngest, it was almost like mom got tired and just let me do whatever I wanted.
And what she wanted was to be out causing mischief with all the other kids.
We ran the town of Nichols. It was, and there was nothing to do. There really wasn't. We didn't we didn't do anything horrible. We just did stupid things. We stayed out late. We got on top of the buildings downtown. We would climb the back of buildings and watch traffic go by. Stupid things like that.
But in a small town, after a while, Annette says there's not much to do to help you stay out of trouble.
We drank very early. We found people that would buy us beer, being young girls, and we drank early and we smoked. And I think the very first time I got drunk, seriously drunk, I was 13.
Mm-hmm.
I could go to my brother Denny's house and I could drink anytime I wanted.
Mm.
Yeah, it became a habit real quick after that.
When Annette was 15, she dropped out of school.
My mom did not make me go to school. I was bored in school and I wanted to be out having fun.
Annette got her GED at community college and continued her party lifestyle. She started working in restaurants and bars.
You know, it was just an easy way for an alcoholic to get free drinks.
Then, at 18, she met a boy.
And I got pregnant, so we got married. And we had two children.
My name is Leanne McCrabb, and I am Annette Cahill's daughter.
Leanne is Annette's oldest daughter. She was born in 1982, and she remembers Annette struggling those early years of parenthood.
Sometimes she'd work one job, sometimes she'd work two jobs. Sometimes she couldn't get a job. There were times when I'd have to get my brother up and get him dressed and take him across town, which wasn't really very far, but take him across town to my grandparents' house so that we could eat breakfast because there was never food in the house.
Mm-hmm.
We wouldn't have electricity. Things like that. You know, we never were... we never had any extra money to do anything.
So like her dad had done for her and her siblings, Annette figured out how to have fun with her kids without spending money.
We would still have, you know, games in the dark, or we would, we lived in Iowa where pop cans were worth 5 cents. We would go looking for cans and then we would go find the silliest dinners for 5 cents per can. So we would buy the silliest dinners from the gas station. She never let us know how much we were struggling.
But they were. Annette was a teen mom trying to keep her life and her children's afloat.
I wasn't a bad mom. I just wasn't the best mom I could be. Looking back, I was young and dumb, and I could have been a much better mom.
Annette's marriage was also rocky. At 26, she got divorced, and her drinking and partying took over.
As we were divorcing, then I hit the bars, and that's when I met Corey.
Corey Winicky.
He was funny, he was sweet, he was kind. He was a sweetheart, he really was.
Corey had been the star football player in high school. Handsome, charming, and popular.
I'm trying to remember if the first time I met him, I think I got called to the bar. I was seeing someone, and the person that I was seeing, like, passed out at the bar. So I had to go get him. And I think Corey was in there at that time. So that, I'm pretty sure that was the very first time I met him.
The bar was called Winks. And Corey worked there. In fact, his family owned it. Winks was a nickname for Winicky. And it was one of the two bars in the tiny town of West Liberty.
Everybody hung out at Winks. Winks and Shenanigans.
Annette wound up working at Winks with Corey.
We just became really good friends.
And they spent all their time together.
I loved him so much.
Leanne remembers Corey.
We'd go to his bar. We'd play pool. He'd give us bags of chips. We'd fall asleep in the booths while mom was working. I mean, it was the 80s, early 90s. It wasn't unheard of. It wasn't taboo back then to have your kids in a bar. We'd hang out, play pool. Everyone knew who we were. And we knew that Corey was her best friend.
But Annette and Corey's relationship was more than platonic.
It was a sexual relationship with the friendship connection. We would be at the bar till closing. We'd make sure everybody was gone, and we would either stay at the bar or we would spend a lot of afternoons together. You know, we'd find another person to bartend and we'd both take off.
Right.
You know, we just spent every minute we could together.
But it was complicated.
He had a fiance.
A fiance. Corey was engaged to his high school sweetheart, Jody Hotz. But it wasn't just Jody he was with.
You know, it was a standing joke that he had relationships with everybody in Muscatine County.
Did his fiance know?
Yes.
Eventually, a friend of Jody's would tell the press that she knew of Corey's affairs. And back in 1992, Annette knew as well about his affairs and his fiance.
Yeah, it was, I knew it and I really didn't care.
Well, it sounds like he didn't care either.
He didn't care at all. I did care. I just didn't care enough. I just didn't care enough. It was very hurtful, and I know that now, but...
You know, it's interesting just thinking about this small town, and it sounds like everyone was hooking up with everyone.
Yeah, it was. It really, truly was. It was, we used to call it Peyton's Place.
What's that?
I don't know if you
no.
probably don't remember Peyton's Place. I'm sorry. You'll have to look that one up on the YouTube.
Okay, a 1964 drama. Got it.
It was a soap opera. That's basically what it was.
Annette says everyone was partying and hooking up with each other. She was also seeing other people.
It wasn't exclusive in any way, shape, or form. It was never going to be.
And Annette says she had bigger worries at the time as her alcohol and drug use started to get out of control. Here's Leanne again.
I saw the drinking. I saw her being passed out on the couch. I knew what it was from. I knew that there was drugs involved.
I did cocaine. That was my drug of choice.
So there were times when she could not be a mom. And I was aware of that.
Do you remember when your dad took custody of you guys?
Yes, I was 10. My brother was 8. I remember it was really rough. We didn't want it to happen. And I remember my mom telling us it was temporary. And she didn't want it to happen either. It was a very emotional time.
Still, Leanne says she's glad her mom made the decision to have someone else care for them for a while.
Because it probably saved us from having to go into state's care. Because I do remember times where the state did show up.
Leanne says one time, Child Protective Services came knocking.
And we had to hide. And she kept us very quiet and she kept us hidden so that we couldn't answer the door. We couldn't make any noise. And I remember that. And that's something that I won't ever forget.
So instead of foster care, Leanne and her brother went to live with their father in Colorado. But that wasn't easy either.
My dad was probably a worse parent. And I held my mom. I was angrier at my mom for that, for putting me in that worst situation. Mm-hmm. And I went through a lot of therapy and I realized it was not my mom's fault that she could not be a parent at that time.
Mm. Annette's life was spiraling.
Hi, I'm Dani Shapiro, host of the hit podcast, Family Secrets. How would you feel if when you met your biological father for the first time, he didn't even say hello? And how would you feel if your doctor advised you to keep your life-altering medical procedure a secret from everyone? And what if your past itself was a secret and the time had suddenly come to share that past with your child? These are just a few of the powerful and profound questions we'll be asking on our 11th season of Family Secrets. Some of you have been with us since season one, and others are just tuning in. Whatever the case, and wherever you are, thank you for being part of our Family Secrets family, where every week we explore the secrets that are kept from us, the secrets we keep from others, and the secrets we keep from ourselves. Listen to season 11 of Family Secrets on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
On Thanksgiving Day, 1999, a five-year-old boy floated alone in the ocean. He had lost his mother trying to reach Florida from Cuba.
He looked like a little angel. I mean, he looked so fresh.
And his name, Elian Gonzalez, will make headlines everywhere.
Elian Gonzalez.
Elian Gonzalez.
At the heart of the story is a young boy and the question of who he belongs with. His father in Cuba.
Mr. Gonzalez wanted to go home, and he wanted to take his son with him.
Or his relatives in Miami.
Imagine that your mother died trying to get you to freedom.
At the heart of it all is still this painful family separation.
Something that, as a Cuban, I know all too well. Listen to Chess Piece, the Elian Gonzalez story, as part of the My Cultura podcast network, available on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, everyone. I'm Madison Packer, a pro hockey veteran going on my 10th season in New York.
And I'm Anya Packer, a former pro hockey player and now a full Madison Packer stan.
Anya and I met through hockey, and now we're married and moms to two awesome toddlers.
And on our new podcast, Moms Who Puck, we're opening up about the chaos of our daily lives between the juggle of being athletes, raising children, and all the messiness in between.
We're also turning to fellow athletes and beyond to learn about their parenthood journeys and collect valuable advice. Like FIFA World Cup winner, Ashlyn Harris.
I wish my village would have prepared me for how hard motherhood was going to be.
And Peloton instructor and Ratchet Mom Club founder, Kirsten Ferguson.
And I remember going in there a hot mess.
So listen to Moms Who Puck, a production of iHeart Women's Sports and Deep Blue Sports and Entertainment on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Presented by e.l.f. Beauty, founding partner of iHeart Women's Sports.
On October 12th, 1992, Annette and Corey were enjoying their usual night of partying at the bar.
So I got drunk stupid.
A heated argument ensued between Annette and Corey about another girl Corey had wanted to take home. But Annette says they eventually made up and he drove her home. At the time, she was living with her brother and his wife in a farmhouse.
We went back to the farm and we had sex. He left. I passed out. And that was the last time I saw him.
The next evening, Annette remembers being at home when two of her coworkers came to the door.
They said, you need to come to the bar. Grandma needs you to attend bar. Corey's sick. And I said, yeah, right. I said, he's got the brown bottle flu.
Annette says she thought she had to cover for Corey because he had a hangover. But when she got to work, she found out the truth. A coworker told her,
he said, He's dead, Annette. And I just lost it.
Annette's best friend, her love, 22-year-old Corey Winicky, was dead. Annette couldn't believe it. She had just been with Corey the night before. That morning, she had even gone to Corey's house to apologize for the argument they'd gotten in the night before. She says she was on her way to run errands in Iowa City with her sister-in-law, Jackie, and they swung by his house. But Corey didn't answer, so they went about their day. At first, Annette says everyone in town thought Corey had been shot.
We thought someone broke in and shot him. Until it was on the news, I don't know, a day or two later, that he had been, you know, bludgeoned.
He is found dead on the floor of his bedroom by his live-in girlfriend, fiance Jody, and he has been beaten to death.
This is Erica Nichols Cook. She's the director of the Wrongful Conviction Unit at the Iowa State Public Defender's Office.
There's no apparent weapon or break-in or known motive. He's in his underwear next to his bed. So the state has a theory that someone that he knew came into the house, was mad at him, and beat him to death.
When you found out he was bludgeoned, what did you think?
I thought angry husband or boyfriend.
Mm.
That was my very first thought.
At least one of the women Corey was seeing had a husband. One woman even had his baby.
He had a relationship with another woman in town, Wendy, and they had a child together, but a child that he didn't acknowledge.
There were also drug-related rumors.
There was speculation about drug dealing, whether he owed a drug debt, and they did like parlays and gambling at the bar, and whether gambling could have been a motive for someone to want to kill Corey.
Being one of the lovers, Annette was also questioned about the murder.
I was obviously a suspect.
Annette and her sister-in-law, Jackie, voluntarily went to the police department because earlier in that day before his body is found, they had stopped at his house. She and Corey had had a fight the night before having makeup sex, and she just wanted to, you know, touch base with him, see him. He didn't answer the door. They had to leave for a doctor's appointment, but they had been there and they wanted to help solve it. So Annette took a lie detector test, told she passed. They didn't have any other suspects that really they could place at Corey's house that day. And the investigation kind of just goes cold.
Leanne remembers trying to have a relationship with her mom long distance after Corey's death.
I wasn't there to see the aftermath or the devastation or the big depression that happened after. I was only there to over the phone to hear it. I remember the tears, the constant tears, and I remember the lack of the phone calls. I remember the phone calls just weeping when we did talk to her, which was heartbreaking because, you know, I was 10 years old, 11 years old. It was real hard to hear my mom like that.
Once again, Annette was a mess.
Just stupid drunk. I was drinking. I was doing drugs.
But then she met Bill Cahill.
I met him in a bar. Well, I didn't meet him in a bar. I saw him in a bar.
Bill was a friend of her brother Denny's, so she'd see him around.
Never thought another thing about him until, you know, we talked and caught up a little bit. He's just a good guy. He's just smart and he's funny and he's more loyal than the day is long.
And Annette says he was good for her.
Our dates weren't based on alcohol. We started going out, and the rest is history. We married in December of 93, and we're still married. There's the thing about Bill. In 32 years of knowing each other, we've never had a fight.
Well, they do argue over classic rock.
He loves Stevie Ray Vaughan. I'm not a big fan. So it just little tiny things like that. That's basically our disagreements. We absolutely agreed how to raise the kids.
Three kids. Annette got her life straight, and Bill took in Leanne and her brother as his own. They even had another child.
My mom did a total 180. Totally grew up as a parent, grew up as an adult. My brother got museums as field trips. He got nutritional meals and museums and the zoo and brand new school clothes and never went without a meal. So by the time my children came along, my children got the best grandma.
My grandkids, okay, so my youngest grandson was born in 2014, and my oldest granddaughter was born in 2000.
Like Annette, Leanne had her first kid young, at 17.
My kids get this grandma who wanted to bake with them and wanted to cook with them and wanted to teach them all her recipes and wanted to fill up the pool in the backyard and go splash around with them. She created this thing called the phenomenal bags with them. So whenever they were good, they'd get to go pick out a dollar store prize out of these bags. So she taught them the word phenomenal and what it meant. And then she'd reward them for the silliest things. And like, it was so neat to see that that was the mom that I was so proud to have. And I'm going to tear up while I'm saying this because that was the mom that I was so proud to see with my kids. That was the mom that I wanted my kids to see that I had. And they love her.
Finally, Annette Cahill was living her best life. An adoring husband, grandkids, baking and playtime. She also had a steady job. She worked as a proofreader and in customer service at the Police Law Institute, which does online training for law enforcement. It was a far cry from her previous life. But she still thought about Corey. She'd even check in with the police for updates.
Through the years, I called them all the time, and asked for updates. You know, please, what's going on? Do you have anything new?
Did you think calling would make you look suspicious? Like, when you were calling, what were you thinking?
Just that, you know, God, maybe they have something new.
And sometimes they did.
Every so often, or every, you know, few years, something would come up, or they would have an agent working on cold cases. They visited a psychic at one point about several other cold cases in the region and tried to get information and leads. They had received some information that a group called the Klan, who was selling drugs in that area at the time, were involved. You know, somebody's girlfriend would come forward and say they bragged about breaking into this guy's house and, you know, killing him with a baseball bat.
A baseball bat was the presumed murder weapon. Investigators searched the ditches on the rural road near Corey's house, but found nothing until a news reporter covering the story spotted a bloody aluminum bat on the road. Police were able to match the blood on the bat to Corey's blood type, but that was it. Despite the leads, nothing panned out for decades.
It was just insane. At that point, I had pretty much convinced myself that I was going to die without ever knowing who committed the crime. So you came to terms with it and kind of moved on.
That was until March 2018, when the police came knocking.
Hi, I'm Dani Shapiro, host of the hit podcast, Family Secrets. How would you feel if when you met your biological father for the first time, he didn't even say hello? And how would you feel if your doctor advised you to keep your life-altering medical procedure a secret from everyone? And what if your past itself was a secret, and the time had suddenly come to share that past with your child? These are just a few of the powerful and profound questions we'll be asking on our 11th season of Family Secrets. Some of you have been with us since season one, and others are just tuning in. Whatever the case, and wherever you are, thank you for being part of our Family Secrets family, where every week we explore the secrets that are kept from us, the secrets we keep from others, and the secrets we keep from ourselves. Listen to season 11 of Family Secrets on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
On Thanksgiving Day, 1999, a 5-year-old boy floated alone in the ocean. He had lost his mother trying to reach Florida from Cuba.
He looked like a little angel. I mean, he looked so fresh.
And his name, Elian Gonzalez, will make headlines everywhere.
Elian Gonzalez.
Elian Gonzalez.
At the heart of the story is a young boy and the question of who he belongs with. His father in Cuba.
Mr. Gonzalez wanted to go home, and he wanted to take his son with him.
Or his relatives in Miami.
Imagine that your mother died trying to get you to freedom.
At the heart of it all is still this painful family separation.
Something that, as a Cuban, I know all too well. listen to Chess Piece, the Elian Gonzalez story, as part of the My Cultura podcast network, available on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, everyone. I'm Madison Packer, a pro hockey veteran going on my 10th season in New York.
And I'm Anya Packer, a former pro hockey player and now a full Madison Packer stan.
Anya and I met through hockey, and now we're married and moms to two awesome toddlers.
And on our new podcast, Moms Who Puck, we're opening up about the chaos of our daily lives between the juggle of being athletes, raising children, and all the messiness in between.
We're also turning to fellow athletes and beyond to learn about their parenthood journeys and collect valuable advice, like FIFA World Cup winner Ashlyn Harris.
I wish my village would have prepared me for how hard motherhood was going to be.
And Peloton instructor and Ratchet Mom Club founder, Kirsten Ferguson.
And I remember going in there a hot mess.
So listen to Moms Who Puck, a production of iHeart Women Sports and Deep Blue Sports and Entertainment on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Presented by Elf Beauty, founding partner of iHeart Women Sports.
More than 25 years after the death of Corey Winnicky, Annette Cahill got a knock on her door. It was Detective John Turbett.
He said he had some, you know, some new information, some good news, you know, had some things he wanted to show me. And I said, oh my God, thank God, finally.
So Annette went with him to the police station.
I walked into the interrogation room and I saw the bat on a table. And I just went cold. And I thought, oh my God, they think it's me. They think it's me. And then it just changed everything.
Annette shut down.
I didn't want to talk to them. I said, you have an hour of my time. I said, that's all I have. I was angry, really, really angry too.
Annette says Bill tried to support her and tell her that the police were just doing their job. And they hadn't accused her of anything yet.
But boy, when they came back in April, he really came at me with, our investigation is closed, Annette, and you're the only one. We think you did it.
So how do they go from all of these leads to Annette? It's one of the craziest things I've ever come across. A DCI agent, Trent Valletta, was working another case and was at the University of Iowa Hospital one night.
It was 2017, and this agent with Iowa's Division of Criminal Investigation says a nurse named Jessie Becker approached him and said,
she was 9 years old in 1992, and she was friends with Annette's niece and told DCI that she knew who killed Corey.
According to Valletta, Jessie proceeded to share a memory she'd been holding on to for 25 years. Jessie said that back in October of 1992, when she was 9 years old, she was at a sleepover with some girls at her friend Kayla's house. Kayla was the daughter of Denny Hazen, Annette's brother. Remember, at the time, Annette lived at her brother's farmhouse. So it was the middle of the night in 1992, and Jessie told Valletta she remembered sneaking down the stairs with another girl for a snack. When they reached the bottom of the stairwell, they were stopped cold by the sound of a woman's voice weeping.
They hear Annette apologizing for killing Corey, telling Corey she's sorry she killed him, she's lighting black candles.
From the stairs, Jessie said they saw Annette sobbing over the black candles, saying, Corey, I never meant to hurt you, and I'm so sorry. I never meant to kill you. I love you. Jessie would go on to tell police that after the sleepover, she had told her mom, Cynthia, what she'd seen. She told her she saw Annette crying and lighting black candles. And Cynthia allegedly told her that even though it was strange, she heard that people sometimes burned black candles to bring out evil spirits. Decades later, Cynthia would corroborate the story, adding that they hadn't come forward because they were scared of Annette. And law enforcement believed them. Several months after Jessie Becker came forward with her story, Leanne remembers being at home.
And my cousin Shauna texts me and says, oh my God, Leanne, I'm so sorry. Have you heard? And I had no idea what she was talking about. And I text her back and I was like, have I heard what? And she says, your mom was arrested. And instantly I knew what for. I knew it was for Corey's murder.
On May 31st, 2018, Annette Cahill was arrested and charged with first-degree murder for the death of Corey Winicky. Almost a year later, she went to trial. Prosecuting attorney Alan Ostergren contended that Annette killed Corey in a jealous rage.
They painted a picture of a woman, like a spurned lover, who wanted to run away with Corey and that was very jealous and mad. So the night before he dies, they're all at Winks, including the baby mother, Wendy. And Annette gets mad and Corey's being mean to her at the bar. And the state argues that Annette had just had enough. And they said that she was so angry at him that she killed him.
Ostergren said that when Annette stopped by Corey's the morning of October 13th, instead of knocking and leaving, like she told police, she actually went in the house and beat him to death with the bat. The state called Jesse Becker and her mom, Cynthia, to testify about what they remembered from 27 years prior. And Jesse retold her story about Annette and the remorseful crying and the black candles. Leanne says it was surreal.
We were like, this is ridiculous. Like, who in the world is going to believe this? Especially off the memory of a 9-year-old 25 years later.
And the jury didn't believe it. They came back hung 9-3 to acquit. But Ostergren was not going to give up.
Well, the county attorney said, you know, we're going to retry this. And we'll come up with some better evidence. Well, how do you come up with better evidence? And then he did. He miraculously came up with Scott Payne.
Scott Payne's mom was good friends with the victim, Corey's mom. And after the hung jury, the moms talked and then called law enforcement and said, you need to talk to Scott because he used to hang out at Annette's house with her brother, and they did drugs together. And he saw them burning bloody clothes.
In a second trial in September of 2019, Scott testified that back in 92, he was at the farmhouse hanging out when he saw Annette burning bloody clothes in a burn barrel. In both trials, Annette's attorney did not present much of a defense.
They called Jackie,
Annette's sister-in-law, her alibi.
But she got so twisted up by and intimidated by the county attorney. The county attorney that did this trial, he has a reputation of being intimidating and hostile. And I don't think she was very prepared for that. And then she had given so many statements over the 20 plus years that it was very easy for her to get confused.
Again, the jury went to deliberate. And again, they came back hung. So the judge ordered what's known as an Allen charge.
The court tells them to keep deliberating, keep trying. And they come back pretty quick after that, unanimously guilty.
Leanne couldn't believe it.
The second time should have been a hung jury, but then the judge says, nope, go back in, I don't accept it. It blows my mind.
Erica says these kinds of charges can be coercive.
If the jurors are telling you that they can't come to an agreement, telling them to keep trying isn't necessarily going to do anything but put pressure on those that are the holdouts. And our research shows there was one or two holdouts that got overpowered by the rest.
On September 19th, 2019, Annette Cahill was convicted of second-degree murder and eventually sentenced to up to 50 years in prison. At 56 years old, essentially, the rest of her life.
You said you don't think you'll ever get used to it. I mean, do you think about the possibility that this is your life now?
Yes, yes. And I think, you know, and people say that if you have not thought of a way to commit suicide, you're a liar. And that's true. If you thought this is what you had to live every day of your life, you would go insane.
But fortunately, someone with resources was paying attention to Annette's case.
I kind of followed it in the news when they made the arrest and thought it didn't sound right. It didn't look right.
What about that? Didn't sound or look right?
The fact that a memory of a child, it was enough. To me, it's just childhood memory is not reliable. And there wasn't any forensic evidence. And in 2019, you expect there to be some forensic evidence, especially in a really close contact offense, right? A beating is really personal. There's blood spatter everywhere, and there's nothing to connect Annette to the bedroom or to a supposed weapon or the victim. And so it always just kind of raised red flags to me.
After her conviction, Annette appealed but lost. So she wrote Erica's office.
And we kind of just jumped on it.
I signed the contract on my birthday. It was a pretty good gift.
And how has that been so far? Do you have more hope now?
I have, all the hope. Yeah. They have worked so hard.
The prosecution relied primarily on the memories of a child to try and convict Annette. And from the jump, Erica and her team found holes in the prosecution's case and Jesse's memories. At trial, Jesse testified that she remembered creeping down the stairwell back in 1992 and seeing Annette from the steps, lighting black candles. But Erica says that would not have been physically possible.
It's not that kind of stairwell. It's an enclosed with walls and a door at the bottom of it. It's not possible.
Do we know who the other child was she said she was with? Did anyone corroborate this?
So we've learned that there were what we believe to be three girls at the sleepover. Annette's niece, Kayla, another friend, Lindsay, and then Jesse. And investigators never talked to Lindsay. And we have. She signed an affidavit that nothing like that ever happened. She, Annette didn't say anything. They didn't creep down the stairs. And that nobody talked to her before the trial.
So did Jesse make this story up?
She might believe she's telling the truth. There's no corroboration for anything that Jesse says. There is, in fact, physical evidence, the layout of the house, that shows that she's wrong, that her memory is wrong. I don't know if she's looking for attention, but this whole tip, this statement, reignited the entire investigation and led to Annette's wrongful conviction.
We reached out to Jesse for comment on Facebook and still haven't heard back. Another detail worth noting is that around 1991, Jesse's stepfather, Lester, had an affair with Annette and later divorced her mother, Cynthia. Though at trial, Cynthia testified that she held no ill will against Annette for sleeping with her husband. During their investigation, Erica and her team wondered, if not Annette, then who? So they followed up on those leads from decades ago.
Claims about who else had motive, what they missed. We have a claim about the live-in girlfriend, Jody, that is fascinating to me because in the discovery we just got, there's letters that Jody wrote to Corey that are evidence that relationship wasn't great.
Jody, Corey's high school sweetheart and fiance.
That perhaps Jody wasn't okay with him having multiple other girlfriends and sleeping with other people and telling him that he's going to have to move out.
Erica also says the letters from Jody to Corey about their relationship being on the rocks were not disclosed to the defense. She says this is a Brady violation, withholding potentially exculpatory evidence.
Once law enforcement believed Jesse Becker, they found her to be credible. She's former military. She's a nurse. The people at the hospital like her. She's telling the truth. They ignored everything that pointed away from Annette. Every other lead.
She says the state did not investigate allegations that Corey had stolen money from Winks, his family bar, that he had a drug debt to dealers, or that he was involved in illegal gambling. But Erica says most troubling,
they didn't even try to do DNA testing before the trial to see if they could connect Annette now. And DNA testing changes every few years.
Erica says the results may have pointed them in a different direction.
We have an unknown female profile on the baseball bat that doesn't match Annette or her sister-in-law, Jackie. And we have a partial male profile on the handle that's not the victim. So we're continuing to investigate there to present evidence of her innocence at trial.
So she was really just convicted on the word of two people's memories, one of which is a 9-year-old from 3 decades ago.
Yes.
Annette has a hearing scheduled for April 2025 to present all the new evidence Erica and her team have found.
So we have an application for DNA testing, and then we filed an application for post-conviction relief, alleging ineffective assistance of counsel, Brady violations for withholding documents from the trial counsels, and presenting false evidence about, you know, different things, and due process, because the jurors, we interviewed jurors, and one of them described going home and researching what reasonable doubt was on her own, which is a no-no. And the issues with the investigation, you know, what they didn't do is what we've been trying to do.
How are you adjusting to her being in prison?
I'm not adjusting. I'm waiting for her to come home. Every time I set up that video chat, I'm just, another little piece of me just chips off.
And from Annette too.
She's even losing her love for drawing. And that's really hard. Because she's just losing pieces of herself as days go by.
Annette wants to be home with her family, back to playing with phenomenal bags and acquainting herself with new additions to the family, her great-grandchildren.
I have 3 greats that were born while I was in here, so I would have to go through my book and get the dates on that. My memory is horrid now. Stress is it's horrible on my memory.
That's something new for you?
Yes, absolutely.
Annette, what do you want people to know about you?
That I'm not a monster. That I've never hurt a soul. I take that back. I haven't physically hurt a soul. I have done some stupid things in my life, but I've never hurt anyone. Not physically. And I have tried my best to make up for any pain I've ever caused anyone. I've tried to be giving and loving and generous and kind this last 30 years because I knew I did some stupid shit when I was young.
You're a very honest person. It seems like you've had a lot of time to think about, you know, life and life's mistakes.
Yeah, and, you know, I'm not gonna sugarcoat what I wasn't, and, you know, there's times when I was good, there's times when I wasn't.
I think that's called being human.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and the older we get, the easier it is to admit that we're not always perfect.
Thank you for listening to Wrongful Conviction with Maggie Freeling. Please support your local innocence organizations and go to the links in the episode description to see how you can help. If you're interested in contacting public officials about Annette's case, you can reach out to the Muscatine County Prosecutor's Office. We'll have links on our website. And if you live in Iowa, you can reach out to your elected officials. This episode was written by me, Maggie Freeling, with story editing and sound design by senior producer Rebecca Ibarra. Our producer is Kathleen Fink. Our mixer is Josh Allen. With research by Allison Levy and additional production help by Jeff Clyburn. Executive producers are Jason Flom, Jeff Kempler, and Kevin Wirtis. The music is by 3-time Oscar-nominated composer J. Ralph. Make sure to follow us on all social media platforms at Lava for Good and at Wrongful Conviction. You can also follow me on all platforms at Maggie Freeling. Wrongful Conviction with Maggie Freeling is a production of Lava for Good Podcasts in association with Signal Company No. 1.